football on Off the Ball.
If someone has a song that referenced Sheffield or Hillsborough about Liverpool crying, we'd be up in arms.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Rugby on Off the Ball.
Anyone can dream it, but to be it, you must never stop competing. Bank of Ireland, a proud sponsor of Irish women's rugby.
Now then, Ireland are back in the Women's Rugby World Cup for the first time since 2017 this weekend. They play Japan on Sunday at midday in Northampton. And someone who was there as a player in 2017 and who will certainly be there as a fan for the duration, I presume, of Ireland's World Cup involvement this year is Anna Capeless. Anna, happy World Cup Day. How are you keeping?
Yeah, happy World Cup. I'm good. I'm in Sunderland, actually.
Fantastic. So you're going to be there for the kickoff tonight. England to win comfortably in that one?
Yeah, should be. I reckon. Like it's such a strange place to have like the opening. Everyone's been kind of remarking it, like, oh, what a strange place to have the rugby. But like Sunderland applied for it, and they won like the bid. And it's so cool. Like, it's actually there's such a buzz around the place. Like, everyone's just so hyped up for it. It's one of those things. It's like Christmas Day. I felt like Christmas Day this morning when I woke up. Everyone's been so excited for it for so long. And I think the stadium tonight's going to be an amazing opening. I just hope that USA can put up a really good challenge to England. But I think England are going to be on one, obviously. You know, it's their home World Cup. It's been coming for such a long time and they want to win this. So they've got to start well tonight. So just hope it's going to be a really good occasion, like, and really good rugby to watch, for good spectacle for people.
Definitely. I think it's important for a host nation to show off different parts of the country to the viewing public at home. Like, it would have been the easy thing to put this at Twickenham tonight, and no doubt it would have come close to the 82,000 as well. But taking it to Sunderland is a really cool idea. I was reading your column, and you've obviously, you probably had knowledge of this a lot longer than I have, I assume. But certainly in the last couple of weeks, I just kind of went down these YouTube wormholes of watching the first couple of Women's World Cups. And like you referenced the Soviet Union in 1991. The big storyline from those early World Cups was just how amazing the USA were. So what's been their journey to the point of tonight, Anna?
Yeah, USA won the first ever Women's World Cup and were the superpower in the opening days. I suppose it was a kind of Canada or somewhat of a similar story. I mean, we saw Ireland play Canada there recently. If people have been following women's rugby, they know that Canada have a super strong team. I think it was the same for USA kind of back in the day, where they weren't in any men's side of the union's shadow, and they were just super strong with athletes coming out of college, and that rugby was one of the contact sports offered to women at university level. So that's where they got, you know, a lot of transfer athletes, a lot of super strong athletes that just came into rugby, while the other nations with the money, let's say, were kind of sleeping. Now, that money was slow to trickle into the other side, just to kind of come into the women's game, you know, like we've seen in around here. But since it's been pumped into like France, England, you know, we've seen it obviously now in Ireland, Wales, like everyone kind of took off, and USA especially got kind of left behind, especially when they started at the heights they did. You know, people will look at those stats and be like, wow, USA really won that, but they had phenomenal athletes and high interest in rugby from college sports.
Yeah, it is fascinating, and anybody who's interested can go back on YouTube and see interviews with some of those United States players in 1991, and they illustrate exactly as you point out there, Anna, the fact that so many of them played other sports, and then their contact sport of choice at university level was to go and play rugby. A theme that's prevailed well beyond the point of 1991 is the idea that England still haven't really managed to dominate this competition. I loved your reference to New Zealand as werewolves, that when the full moon comes out, i.e. the World Cup begins, they really reach a new level, to the bane of English rugby fans, more so than anybody else, Anna.
It's so frustrating because everyone wants what England have. And if England continued to lose this competition, and it is theirs to lose, it has been theirs to lose for the last number of years, because they're the ones that are investing the best out of everybody. France, you could have argued at a time, but not anymore. they keep losing it. And all we want to say is like, yes, England are the winners, England are the champions. Now, can we all just copy this, please, this format? And just, this is obviously what works. However, England ramped things up in terms of investment long before anyone else did, kind of thinking that other unions would be quicker to follow suit. And they kind of surpassed everybody so heavily that actually they only get challenged once every 4 years. Like, maybe this will work out and that COVID delayed the last World Cup. So the last World Cup actually was only 3 years ago. Maybe it's close enough to have such a chunk of the squad still so close to that losing feeling. Like, I was in the stadium when they played the Black Ferns in the final of the World Cup in 2022, and they lost the last line out. Like, the line out was 5 meters out. It was a given. Like, I don't know, had they lost a line out in the World Cup and Black Ferns went up, stole the line out, I'm still shook from it. It was such a moment, like, amazing for the Black Ferns. It was such an amazing tournament. But at the same time, the Black Ferns, in terms of investment, like from their union, etc., hadn't done enough to deserve to win a World Cup. And here is England putting everything in, like making full-time athletes, like giving, you know, the players what they want and what they deserve, actually, and they can't win it. But I think it's because they only get challenged so seldom. I remember actually the Black Ferns came to England for a test match series the November before everyone went down to that World Cup in Auckland in New Zealand in 2022, and they were absolutely pants. Like, it was actually embarrassing. They were like, oh my god, I can't believe this is the gulf between these two teams now. And I was living with one of the English girls at the time because I was playing in Gloucester Harpery. And I said to her, like, you got to watch out for them because, like, it's not them losing this much. It seems to send a message. It won't, like, they'll turn up an absolutely different machine and they'll use how much they've lost this by this series and how embarrassing they were to oil their machine. And she was like, yeah, I know. But oh, my god, was that. That was so right. Like, they literally turned up like a werewolf at their home World Cup. And they're set to do the same. Everyone's talking about it. They've got some sevens players that came across that are unreal.
Right.
Like, they're Georgia Miller in the back row. She's been outstanding for them. And, like, Portia Woodman Whitcliffe, who retired after the last World Cup, was like, took a bit of time off and they asked her to come back. She was like, okay. And now she's back in the squad. I think everyone else was like, oh no, can't be dealing with her again because she's scored the most international tries out of anybody ever, men's or women's. She's unreal. So they could do it again, but they won't meet England in a final this time because of how the groups work out.
Unless Ireland beat New Zealand.
That's a big mission, isn't it? And everyone knows, like, Brighton and rugby is not a synonymous thing.
No.
But everyone remembers Brighton for one rugby moment, which was Japan beating South Africa in the 2015 World Cup.
Yes, of course.
That's what everyone remembers. Brighton and rugby goes together because of that reason. So, like, is that a theme down in Brighton? Now, I'm talking about this as if it's like some massive upset. Ireland already beat the Black Ferns last year. So it's not as massive as you know, Japan, South Africa. It's a little closer than that. But like the well-oiled machine werewolf kind of analogy thing, Black Ferns aren't going to be messing around like they were in WXV. So Ireland need to be at their best and they have to be banking on the Black Ferns not being the World Cup Black Ferns that usually turn up. And then we've got that 2014 memory. I'm sure the girls will be talking about that like Ireland also beat the Black Ferns in 2014 at that World Cup. So it's not impossible.
The John Giles era with Off the Ball has come to an emotional end.
Off the Ball wouldn't exist the way it does without the existence of John Giles.
Helped by a plethora of John's friends and family within and without football, we pay tribute to the great man in in front of a selected audience.
So we are here tonight to celebrate not just the impact John has had on Off the Ball over the last 20 years or so, but really the unrivaled impact that he's had on Irish football going back 70 years.
This week in the OTB football feed, look out for the full John Giles tribute night.
If we didn't say John was the best player I've ever played with, he would tell you why he was.
Eddie, I might come to that in a minute. Yeah.
We speak to John himself about his 7 decades in football, former Leeds teammates Eddie Gray and Joe Jordan, plus tributes from Liam Brady, Brian Kerr and many more.
As you say, it's what, 20 odd?
23 years.
20 years. Well, they did well to put up with me for 20 years.
Released in 3 parts, we'll drop the first part of the John Giles tribute night on Tuesday morning. And to mark the occasion, it will be available for free for a limited time only. The John Giles tribute, only available in your OTB football feed.
Hopefully in 2 weeks' time, we'll be able to, you know, delve a little bit deeper into what you're talking about there. Ireland have to do their stuff first of all. I mean, they have their own dark memories of Spain. Obviously, that's why they didn't play in the last World Cup, losing to the Spanish. That's next weekend. As I say, it's Japan this weekend. And coming into this, I think we've been kind of like looking ahead to the World Cup. Throughout the Six Nations, we were previewing the World Cup, basically. It was a World Cup year. Everything was geared towards it. But since the two key injuries, it kind of feels now, in a brutally optimistic way, that it's good that they happened when they happened. Because if they happened in the last couple of weeks, it would have been a complete disaster. It feels that Scott Beaman and the coaches and the rest of the players have now compartmentalised that. Obviously heartbreaking that neither of them are going to be able to play. Two of Ireland's great modern players, them not playing is a disaster for them. But I think it feels now the squad have moved past that. It's now something in the rearview mirror.
Yeah, it's a good point, actually. And as well, the proof is kind of in the pudding there, because they lost to Scotland in the last round of the Six Nations, just kind of after those injuries had happened. And they beat Scotland in a warm-up a couple of weeks ago. So that in itself shows that, okay, yeah, they have been able to kind of just work with the depth. Because the thing is, when you have star players like that, if you're sitting, you know, 2-3 positions behind a player like Darth Wall or Aaron King or Aoife Wafer for that matter, you're kind of like, well, my place is gone, or you could be potentially, and there'll be something kind of small in your mind. So having those players gone, and like, think about like, Dorothy is between second and back row, so like her injury, for sure there are girls who sit up a little bit straighter like, oh, that's me. I want to be next in line, you know. So that changes mentality as well, a small bit around those positions, because they are all between second row and back row positions as well. So you've got to go looking there for the girls who might have been slightly resting, you know, not sitting back. I'm not accusing anyone of sitting back, but there is that mentality of knowing where you sit in those pecking order, especially when you're behind world-class players like that, because being totally ready to take over someone if they get injured is really hard to sustain. Like, you can't be like having that mentality all the time. It's those who were behind her are now stepping into her place. And you can see it, like the back row that's like, they've named, for example, Fiona Chute named there at 6, like super excited for her. I think I've been so impressed by her when she's been given her chance. But again, the players that are ahead of her meant that she's been biding her time. So super excited for her. Thankfully, Adele McMahon is back in there as well. Brittany Hogan was kind of being moved about, but like back at 8, you know, there was this thing of like Aoife Wafer wearing 6 but playing at 8, or maybe was it vice versa? I'm trying to think back, but now it's like, it's a really strong back row, and of girls who've been kind of like building into it. It's not a surprise, like you've been saying already.
Yeah, and you'd imagine the Fiona Toot part of that is the stopgap, and it would suggest, you know, moving from the second row to the back row, you're adding a bit of heft to the back row, because we do expect Wafer to be back. What's your general instinct on how best to play the Wafer situation? The reports seem to be consistent that she could play against New Zealand. These first two games, don't expect to see for Wafer. Would you start her in 2 weeks' time, say, if Ireland have won two games, given the way in which it obviously present them with a much more forgiving quarterfinal were they to win that game?
That lies in, I suppose it's Fiona Tude's hands, really. And then there's Grace Moore as well, who might come in next week into that back row, who was phenomenal in the warm-up, so deserves a shot as well. It lies in their hands, really. Like, if they're, you know, outstanding, you know, giving off the vibe that they've been there, like, you know, this whole time, and we're talking about them instead of looking forward to having Aoife Wafer back, that's up to them, you know. They and because if you have like players who've done outstandingly well, and then Scott Beeman's like, you've been brilliant, but we're just going to put her back in, that needs really careful conversation, and really you can't frustrate those players then, like, well, I've done everything you've asked me, and I've still lost my starting place, even though we're not sure if Wafer is on form or not. So that, you know, let's see. Time will tell with that one, I think. If there is a little bit of some kind of hairy moments across the next two weekends, which I actually expect there will be, because Japan and Spain haven't, you know, they've been around the block. They're not coming to a World Cup just to mess around. They're going to do everything to disrupt whatever Ireland is going to try to create. Like, if there are players that can rise above that, I wouldn't see Scott Beeman making any changes to a good squad that's already proved they're good enough to go in against New Zealand.
There are a heap of interesting storylines from the team that was named today. So you got Adele McMahon, obviously back from injury. She was dealing with a knee problem. It's Ivana Kiripati who misses out. You've mentioned Fiona Tooth there, going from the second row to the back row as part of that. Sam Monahan coming into the team. You've got Emily Costigan on the wing with Anna McGann going to the bench, and then Eve Higgins at inside centre with Enya Breen dropping to the bench. What I did want to ask you about, and this was expected, obviously, that Dan O'Brien and Aveen Riley would be the half-back pairing. To what extent have they developed that relationship where you feel truly comfortable in it? Because if you look at the Six Nations this year, there were three half-back pairings. It was Dan O'Brien the whole time, but Emily Lane started the Six Nations. Aveen O'Riley played two of the games, and then Molly Scuffle McCabe played the last two games. So on Six Nations evidence, i.e. their last competitive games, maybe there's still a bit of work to be done on that partnership.
You know, what we don't see then is the hours and hours of training.
Yeah.
Where there's obviously, you know, massively good vibes going on, like, you know, high fives and hugs and like cheering. And, you know, these players have to play against each other then. Talking about the kind of, the nine dilemma, or the nine triangle that we have, and very lucky to have as well. They're probably sparks flying between them all, and they're really pushing each other. So we're going off, we're talking about performances that we can see. There's obviously an awful lot going on in camp as well. So he had the pick of the bunch, really, between the nines. Like, I think Emily Lane and Aveen Riley both work really well with Dan O'Brien, and he's just gone with this because of the feeling he's getting. I don't think there's anything missing there from any of the nines, really. I think any of them could do what Scott Beeman wants and what Dan O'Brien wants. I think Aveen kind of struggled a little bit the last year, but I think that the slow kind of start versus Canada, they were kind of are still maybe a bit shell-shocked, or just kind of bringing themselves together in the first half. They didn't hit their rhythm. The ball wasn't getting presented quickly enough. So I think Aveen was under a bit of pressure. So I wasn't sure, was he going to stick with Aveen? But actually, at the end of the day, it's about giving them game time together. So that makes sense that they've, you know, played the last game together, and now they'll carry that in. Because if you are changing enough, like, the thing is, at the end of the day, you just have to make a decision around one or the other. I think there are three outstanding options between Riley Lane and Scuffle McCabe. And again, it's about it being managed. And you might even change it up next week. But it does make sense that the last warm-up game is the same selection, especially in the halfback pairing, for the first round.
When it comes to players who've got World Cup experience, Cliona Maloney-McDonald is the only one who was there in 2017, former teammate of yours. Does 2017 bring back joyous memories for you, Anna? Does it come with a what could have been sort of sense? I guess it was a better outcome than it was, whatever, 3-4 years ago at this point. Where does it sit in your consciousness?
Sadly, there aren't a lot of good memories around the World Cup in 2017. There are some, and I'm still glad that I was there. to have been there to be part of what was kind of unraveling, I suppose, because it was a bit of an, it was the beginning of the unraveling of the kind of downward spiral that went on for a while. So I'm glad that I was in the front row for that instead of elsewhere, you know, like, because it was my time. That was my time to come into the squad. And I was very a young, I'd only one cap, I think, coming into that World Cup. It wasn't managed very well. Like, there was a lot of, you know, the kind of mashing the sevens and 15s together without any kind of conversation around it. It was just left to the players to deal with. And it was managed really poorly in a lot of ways that, you know, we've learned from and we reflected on, we gave the feedback, and now, you know, it's not a, you know, I'm not trying to like bring this up as a waving my finger kind of thing. We have learned from it, and that we've been, you know, promised that we've learned from it. But that was a really, really hard time. Personally, it was really, really difficult. I'm very aware that like the what the players are going through at the moment. So when I look at team lists, I'm like, oh my God, who's not there? Oh my goodness, like she's, you know, I'm thinking of the selection all the time of like who's left out here or who's been dropped or who, like that's, I'm thinking of that an awful lot because I went through that in 2017 and it was awful. And I didn't know who to turn to because you don't want to burden your teammates then with your worries because they've got worries as well. And certainly in 2017, we had a lot, it started really well. And then Japan was a big, you know, fork in that kind of beginning of the struggle for us. We beat Australia on the opening night. We played Japan a week later, who were extremely tough. Like Japan probably started to rock the boat for us really, because we struggled to beat them. We only beat them very late in the game. And I was on the bench. And they didn't make the changes. So I was on the high bench, so not selected for the first game. I was really disappointed, but you know, you're there for the team. And I was like, my chance will come. Second game was Japan. I was on the bench and I didn't get on the field because it was so close. He just didn't want to make the changes. And then I got dropped again for France. So now the three pool games have been and gone and I didn't play in any of them. And in, we lost against France. And then we went from Dublin to Belfast the next day. It was just a really, really tough place to be. We couldn't find the answers and we were trying so hard and everyone was there 100%. Like there was no, even the management, it was just that there was like, there was something really missing and something really grating on us. And then going forward, we played Australia again and we lost. And then we lost the I'm losing my figures now, I feel it was the eighth place playoff to Wales, and because of that match we didn't qualify for the following World Cup, so that's why we had to go through the whole qualification process that eventually ended in us not qualifying for the World Cup. So sadly 2017 is not, so much learned from it and it was like massive for us, but it's not a, I would hate that players are still going through something like that, not just in Ireland but in other countries as well, that kind of has to change.
Yeah and like I didn't want to put words in your mouth, but that's why I asked the question. We have to remember it's kind of a pair of World Cups that we're rebounding from. It's not just the one that we didn't qualify for, because obviously the home World Cup, the promise of what happened at the previous competition, expectations from the outside were very high, but actually what was happening inside was completely suboptimal. And thankfully things seem to have changed. The outside mood seems a lot better, but the inside mood seems stronger as well. If I had to ask you finally, Anna, what's your expectation for Ireland's conclusion to this World Cup? If you had to give us a stage, what do you reckon?
I'm hoping for two convincing wins, Japan and Spain, when it's Ireland at their best, and I think they've done enough to be at their best at this stage. Do you know what? I don't want to jinx it.
Yeah, fair
I don't
enough.
Want to jinx it. So I'm going to say that the pool is going to finish how it starts. So they'll qualify. They'll get to a quarterfinal. France are a funny one. It could potentially be France, or it could be Italy, who finish in the other World Cup. I want the pools to change. Like, if you look at the pools and you'd match them all up, if you had a predictor, it looks as if they could just finish the way they start, and then all the ranking will just mean that that's how you'll finish. But this is the World Cup, so yeah. Something's got to change. Something's got to go wrong somewhere, and it could be with France. You know, they've got Italy first, and Italy are the ones to. France are a little bit scared of Italy, you know, and Italy could rock them a little bit, and they're also missing Pauline Bourdon-Sanchez, who's still on a red card, which I said in the article. So that could be a big opening game for France, Italy this weekend. And if we got Italy in a quarterfinal, I'd back us to get to semi-final.
Fantastic. That's a good way of framing it. What Ireland can do, what they can achieve is pretty lofty. Anna, great to chat to you as always. Enjoy the World Cup.
Thanks, Emil. Bye.
Rugby on Off the Ball.
Anyone can dream it, but to be it, you must never stop competing. Bank of Ireland, a proud sponsor of Irish women's rugby.